ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानं जनशलाकय चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नाम श्रेष्ठं मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रं मत्रास्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरोपरि माथुरीं गष्टावतीं राधाकुण्डं गिरिवरं महो राधिकमधावशम् प्राप्तो यस्य प्रतीत्तकृपाया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि वञ्चकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानं पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः निखिलाश्रुतिमौले रत्नमालद्युति निराजिता पदपङ्कजन्त अजिमुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितष्टं हरिणं संश्रयामि नारेपितचरिं चिरात् करुणयावतीर्णाकलुः क्षमार्पयितुमुन्नत च बलरासं स्वभक्तिश्रियं हरिपुरता सुन्दरद्युतिकदम्बसन्दीपितः सदा हृदये खन्दरे स्फुरतो वासचिनन्दनः अज्जानुलम्बिता भुजो कनकावदातु सङ्कीर्तनैकपितरो कमलायतक्षु विश्वम्बरो द्विजाबरो जुगधार्मपालो वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारो लादिनी शक्तिस्वरूपाय गौरङ्गसुहृदाय च भक्तशक्तिप्रदनाय गदाधर नमस्तुते हे कृष्णकरुणासिन्धुदीनाबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेशा गोपीककान्त राधाकान्त नमस्तुते राधे वृन्दवनादिषि करुणमृतवाहिनि कृपया निजपादब्जा दशन्मह्यं प्रदीयतम् भक्त्या विहीनाय अपराधलक्षये क्षिप्तश्चाकमादितरङ्गमाद्य कृपां मयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दम् श्री सचिनंदन गौर हरि की जय श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद की जय श्री श्री गौर गदाधर जी की जय श्री श्री राधा मदन मोहन की जय श्री श्री राधा गोविंद देव की जय श्री श्री राधा गोपीनाथ जी की जय अबीर बाब महोत्सव तिथि श्री वृंदावन दास ठाकुर की जय गौर भक्त वृंद की जय गौर प्रमाण हरि हो Pranam to all of you. Welcome. Thank you so much for being today present and giving me your association and your valuable time. As I always like to say, Krishna the Bhagavad Gita say, I'm time personified. So if you are giving me your time, you are giving me Krishna because he's time personified. So thank you so much for giving me Krishna in the form of time and in many other forms as well. Attentive time, presence, and sincere openness to whatever may need to manifest, blossom in today's gathering, which I may have some idea in my own mind, but this is all about what happens when all of us get together. If I may come with my own plan, but each one of you have a plan, have something churning there, so the unique combination of all of this simultaneous churnings give its own result. No? So I'm open to that as well. I try to commit in your presence to this gathering. So whatever needs to be churned in each other's hearts, and all of us may be a byproduct of that churning, so to say, right? So it's 50-50, just in case I'm saying that, right? I'm sitting in this fancy higher seat, but that doesn't mean too much. I have a fancy harmonium table, but we are all churning the same ocean together, basically, no? From different perspectives, and we are here to support one another because when we need each other, that's sankirtan. You cannot engage in sankirtan by yourself. By ourselves, we can only do some kirtan, but sankirtan It records Sangha Kirtan, Samyak Kirtan, Sambandha Kirtan, all together with the awareness of the interrelatedness of everything and our participation with a common center, which is made of unconditional love. The center of reality is Krishna, and Krishna is non different from love. So the center of reality is unconditional love. Everything revolves around that center. That's reality. When we perceive something else, we call that non-reality or Maya. So here we are all together to remind ourselves of the common center and of the way to constellate around such a common center. So the topic that has been selected for the next 3 days has been one that was not in my mind, as it was not in my mind to be here. It was not in my mind to talk on this, at least till last week. But somehow, different situations, different dynamics took me to the conclusion, let's talk about this. Let's talk about self-love in bhakti, which for some may sound even an oxymoron. Is it possible? First of all, we'll try to speak if it's possible at all. And if that's possible, how it's possible, how we can express self-love, self-care, self-compassion in a way that is nourishing our bhakti and our connection with the center, with everything else, which is, of course, also connected with that common center. So we'll talk about that throughout the 3 days. Again, I have an idea, but the rest is I'm throwing in for an adventure. That's what life should be. At least I'm more concerned with. Like, we are to follow the steps of our deity and our God, Krishna. He's way more interested in adventure than in preserving the status quo, so to say. So we have to somehow represent the spirit of our Easter Dev. So let's hopefully jump together into the adventure of Harikatha, basically, you know, which is an ocean unto itself, a journey unto itself. So I decided to talk on this topic because also I feel it's somehow connected to my inner process, although I don't want to sound selfish in saying that. No, it's my connect to my process, or I'll talk about what's connected to my process. But at the same time, I feel it can reflect the process of each of you. And I cannot talk about something that is not connected to my journey. It doesn't work for me. As I cannot write a book on something that it's not a chapter of my journey. I cannot just, Maharaj, please, can you write a book on this? If it's not a vibrant part of that chapter of my life, it's like, not yet, sorry. So in this case, a big part of my journey, so to say, in this present moment, is the need for further grounding in bhakti. And what do I mean by that? It means that the Gaudiya Vaishnavism is a beautiful tradition, which is full and filled with so many details and information about post-liberated life and all the details of what happens in the Leela and so on and so forth. And we have such a super lofty ideal in transcendence. I totally agree with it, and I'm all for that. And because I'm all for that, I feel the need of profound grounding on certain basic truths that will be the proper foundation for the temple that I want to construct in my heart. We all want to make this Mama Mandir, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, temple in their heart. But what's the, how do you say in English, foundation? Okay, what's the foundation of that architectonical project or whatever? No? So there has to be some grounding. And for me, in part, the grounding is we have to be able to talk about basic things in a very profound way. I prefer that way than talking about very high things in a very basic way. That for me is a dishonor to that reality. So because we want so badly that highest reality, we'll talk about very basic topics hopefully in a very grounding way. So if we can speak so deeply about something basic, what to speak of how deeply we can talk about the highest reality? So we talk in a way that we are honoring our highest ideal and preparing the soil and preparing the foundation for a realistic project in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And not that we embrace a lofty idea in transcendence as an escape from unresolved foundational issues as human sadhakas, where we are today, here and now. So for me, that's very important. The way I put it in brief words, the way I want to relate with God, that must be reflected in how I relate with everything else. So I would like to serve and love Krishna in this particular way. That's great. But how somehow or other that loving dedication is being reflected in how I relate to other people, to the world of matter, and to ourselves even. So the quality of our attainment has to be reflected in how we relate to everything else. There's no way around it, at least for me. And that's how we are projecting our practice and our ideals in a sustainable, realistic way. So that's where I am at now, here now. And from that place, I feel the need to talk about some of these truths. I've tried to talk about that in my book on radical personalism on some degree of another, and somehow or other, this is kind of an extended reflection on that, because that's what happens. You write the book, and after you write the book, you start to enter into that anxiety of, oh my gosh, I could have said so many other things. And of course, you can write another book after. And that's how it works, basically. You know? So we are writing another book. So part of that is also what we will be sharing these days. And I remember a few months ago when we were giving a lecture on what's Tadatmya Sangha, what's the principle of Tadatmya or mystical empathy. We talked about the importance of being empathic, empathizing with others, empathizing with God's will. But we didn't touch the point of somehow empathizing with ourselves, if we want to talk like that, self-empathy. So that we will talk these days here. So the title I've selected is, again, Self-Love in Bhakti. That's the title. And of course, when I say bhakti, I don't know if I'm knowing some of you for the first time. Some of you may not be, officially subscribed to the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, may be connected with some other mystical tradition. So when I'm saying bhakti, I'm not making it exclusive to the bhakti tradition I am part of. No? So it's a general term to refer to any spiritual path in this case we may be treading. So how to embrace self-love in the context of loving God, let's put it like that. And we will explore these days. Now, is self-love possible in bhakti? It is. That's the case. Yeah. If not, the class is over now, and that's the end of the series. So it is. But how will that look like? You know, how self-love can be expressed in a way that is at the same time humble and realistic, sustainable, acknowledge a common center, not narcissistic, of course, because that's not very self-loving. But we don't want to practice self-love at the expense of bhakti, and we don't want to be in that practicing bhakti at the expense of self-love, because that can happen also. So we want to embrace a practice that is empowering, not disempowering, healing, not traumatizing. Sometimes both things can happen. If we don't have the proper orientation to the practice, something that originally, substantially has the potential of empowering and healing can totally disempower and even traumatize us. I won't start entering into details of our unauthorized biographies here. It's not the confession chamber now, but I think we all somehow have some experience of that, firsthand or secondhand. So we'll be talking about that, self-love in bhakti, and the subtitle says learning to relate to ourselves. So again, sometimes we may in our bhakti tradition or some other spiritual tradition emphasize or overemphasize, you have to love Krishna, you have to love Krishna, and in such a way that you forget that loving Krishna implies loving everything else. Because from one side of the equation, you cannot talk about anything else separated from Krishna. So if you love Krishna, you have to love everything else. If you don't love everything else, with all respect, you don't love Krishna. Like the other day, I was reading from the other day, a few months ago, Bhakti Rasa posted one quote from Dorothy Day. I say that a few times. This idea was said by her in a very unique way, almost shocking, but very precise. She said, she was praying to God, and she said, "Oh my Lord, I only love you as much as I love the person I love the least." I will repeat it for better impact. Oh Bhagavan, I only love you as much as I love the person I love the least. In other words, my love for you has to be reflected all the way down to the person I love the least. Hopefully there is no person I love the least, but my point is, even to that point, the love for the center has to be reflected. Again, that's how the Shastra is saying. If you are the highest type of devotee, you will see Krishna everywhere. And if you love Krishna and you see Krishna everywhere, that means you love whatever you are seeing, whatever Krishna is manifesting, right? So anyhow, the idea is trying to emphasize including that principle, and we are included in that principle. If loving Krishna implies loving everything else, we happen to be part of that everything else. So how to love ourselves in the context of loving God, in the context of the center. So one of the main sections from the scripture, of course I will try to support all this with our tradition, and quotes from Shastra here, it's not Swami Padmanabha bringing a new Siddhanta and Sampradaya, just in case you can relax. So one of the main verses that came to mind to support the presentation is a famous verse from Bhagavad Gita that I like a lot. It's from second chapter, verse 29. So before this verse, Krishna is describing the soul. Krishna is describing the soul, but in negative terms mostly, by saying what the soul is not. Because it's difficult to speak about consciousness. Because when you describe something, you tend to compare that with something to give a better idea. Like if you never heard about a mridanga, and suddenly you heard me saying the mridanga, you will ask me, what's a mridanga? And I don't think you will be even able to pronounce mridanga. No? What's that word you just say? And I have to tell you, I have to give you some point of reference. So I will say it's a drum. You know a drum, what a drum is? Well, it's kind of a drum. Unique, but it's a drum. But if I say, okay, I will talk about consciousness, about the soul, but the soul is categorically different from any other substance on the material sphere. So I cannot just give you an example from this world to fully describe what the soul is. So Krishna starts to describe the soul, saying what the soul is not, denying all the possibilities that apply to matter in connection to consciousness. But no, the soul cannot be burned, cannot be dry, it's not dying, it's not born, so on and so forth. And when he reaches the point of, okay, let's say something positive about the soul. No, let's not just be engaging via negativa, no? Which basically means in Latin, to speak negatively about something, what that something is not. Let's say what the soul is. So he reaches this verse, 229, where he pronounces the word ascharya three times. And ascharya means amazing. So what's the soul? Amazing. 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 Basically, Krishna is telling, you are amazing. You're amazing, amazing, amazing. If that's not, if you cannot get from that self-loving bhakti, I mean, I don't know from where you can grasp it. No? And that's not me saying that, that's the sweet absolute himself, no? Confessing his heart to us. So in this verse, very interestingly, Krishna says that some people consider the soul as amazing, some other people speak of the soul as amazing, and some other people hear of the soul as amazing. In other words, the idea is, the soul is so amazing that whomever does something in connection to it is amazing. And then he says, interestingly, at the end, others, even after hearing about it, can't comprehend it at all. So again, the word used here is ascharya. It's translated here as amazing, but in Sanskrit, ascharya means many things, all of them connected with this idea of amazing. But I will mention a few others so we have a more clear idea of that. Ascharya can refer to wonder, astonishment, something marvelous, extraordinary. It also can mean shock, So it's shockingly amazing. And even miracle. Miracle. So you can figure out what Krishna is saying here when he says, you are Acharya. You are a miracle. You are shockingly astonishing. You're marvelous. You're extraordinary. I mean, each one of us would like to hear our partner saying that a few more times a day. When someone in this world will tell me something like that. But the most important thing is that the most important person is already saying the most important thing here. So the soul is shockingly marvelous. Wow, astonishing, extraordinary. You are a unit of wonder. Let's put it like that. The soul is a unit of awe and wonder. Acharya, you are a miracle unto yourself. If we properly understand these words, we won't get proud and arrogant and think I'm the center of the universe. Ideally, this will move us, humble us. This is Krishna talking to you, saying all these nice things to each one of us. So all this is summed up somehow in the word amazing, because you can imagine our acharyas when translating this verse, they had to find one word, but all these other things are implied into acharya, amazing. You are amazing. The soul is amazing. So in the main commentaries, today I was reading your Guru Maharaj's commentary, Srinarayan Maharaj's commentary to this verse, and he was saying that. He was saying, the soul is so amazing that this verse here is saying that whomever considers the amazingness of the soul is amazing. Whomever talks about the amazingness of the soul, does that word exist, amazingness? I mean, you understand what I mean. So whomever considers the amazingness of the soul is also amazing. Whoever speaks about that is amazing. If you hear about the amazingness of the soul, you're amazing. We are doing all that now here, so we are all amazing. Again, not by our own merit. Again, this is not just a promotion to feel better than anyone, just to celebrate the fortune of contacting the amazingness of who we are. Who we are not our own creation. So there's no reason for becoming proud about who I am, because it's not that I've created myself. It's just discovering the miracle of my existence by Krishna's grace. So for me, this implies self-love in bhakti, in brief, to learn and acknowledge our amazingness. That's self-love. You love yourself by acknowledging, by honoring your amazingness in bhakti, in certain context, not like in isolated, separated context with I'm amazing unto myself, I'm my own creation, this is all my whole merit, and the whole of the universe revolves around me. We are not promoting that here. This amazingness is not our own creation. But the very reality of our existence is amazing. And of course, the very reality of the existence of everything else. That's what balances the equation. You are amazing, and so is everyone else. Just in case I'm clarifying. That's why I'm trying to look at everyone and not just saying to one person, you're amazing, you're amazing. And what about all of us? So everything, not only everyone, everything is amazing. Ultimately, you have to enter that stage where every atom is oozing awe and wonder. Sorry if it sounds like I'm becoming too poetic, but at one point you need poetry to describe certain depths and intimacy of reality. Poetry is the only language. That's what Chaitanya Charitamrita to say. One point of discourse, you can only resort to poetry. One word missing there. But basically that. When talking about the higher things, poetry is the only resource. So again, everything is gifted with amazingness. So in that sense, everything is amazing. In that sense, all of us are invited into a journey of, in Sanskrit will be chamatkar, wonder, and astonishment. And try to imagine, Brahma Samhita says, in every atom, God is fully present. Try to think about that for 10 seconds until smoke starts to come here. And that's not something to think about in one point. You think about, you make all your faculties collapse, And then you open yourself to another form of revelation and interaction, basically. However, the Bhagavad Gita verse that we are talking about says, about all this amazingness, perhaps there is something that is even more amazing than all this, and it's the fact that most of us cannot see how amazing we are. Interestingly, Krishna concludes it like on a sad, compassionate note. Like, all this is so amazing, but perhaps more astonishing is that most people are not aware of this. They live their lives completely unconscious of their amazingness and everyone else's amazingness by extension. So we have to do something about it. Because many times, instead of seeing our amazingness in a healthy way, we perceive ourselves probably in two ways. I mean, many, but probably two. One, trying to see myself as amazing, but without contacting the soul, the real amazing thing, and seeing myself separated from everyone else. And I try to be amazing by myself, but not understanding everyone is already amazing. So that throws us into a, like, exhausting struggle. Trying to be amazing, trying to perform amazing, so to say, while you're already amazing. And Krishna already loves unconditionally that amazingness that you are. No need to earn Krishna's love by becoming amazing, by doing some performing, performative feat and blah, blah, blah. Even in the context of sadhana bhakti. No need to become a superhero in Krishna consciousness. So that's one way we can try to be amazing in a toxic way. And another way is just basically we conclude, I'm not amazing. I'm unamazing. I'm unworthy. I'm ontologically flawed. I'm unlovable. Many of us, unfortunately, are convinced about that. Consciously and unconsciously, we may walk our life thinking, I'm not enough. I will never be enough. And so on and so forth, instead of connecting with the amazingness of the soul. And in both cases, again, we are seeing ourselves disconnected from the center. We are seeing ourselves as isolated units, like dualism, separatism, fragmented consciousness. What we see here, ourselves, and everything else somewhere else, where everything is actually perfectly integrated. What's your name?
Shaina.
Today we were talking with Shaina before, and she mentioned these beautiful two words, interconnectedness and interwoven. So everything is interwoven and interconnected. And I was like, yes, that's a trailer of today's lecture. Beautiful. When we lose sight of that connection we have with everything else and we see ourselves from a separate I, sense of I, that becomes toxic. No? That's why you use the word, we can put it in this word, in this way. What's the difference between illness and wellness? One begins with I, the other begins with we. So when you just think in terms of I as a separate unit from the we, that's illness. When you understand we are integrated as a common whole, non-separated, in one sense, that's called wellness. And it's not, this is not just grammar, of course. So anyhow, based on this Bhagavad Gita verse 229, I think we have scriptural proof that there is possibility for self-love in bhakti. There is a way of seeing ourselves as amazing in a legal way. Not transgressing our teachings, our teachers. And on the basis of this verse, I will try to unfold a main thesis throughout these 3 days, which is basically the following. Some of us, or most of us, are practicing bhakti. And bhakti means basically, let's say, loving Krishna, to put it simply. And one of the best ways to motivate our loving Krishna is to realize Krishna already loves me. So Krishna loves me, and I would like to love him. And to love him means to love whatever, to love someone means to love whatever is connected with that someone. Prabhupada will put it in the words, if you love me, you love my dog. So if you want to love Krishna, you are supposed to love whatever is connected with Krishna, and everything happens to be connected with Krishna. There's nothing that you cannot not love in your project of loving Krishna, including yourself. You follow my point? So I want to love Krishna, but loving Krishna is loving whatever is related to him. Everything is related to him, including me. So I must learn how to love everything in the context of my project of loving Krishna. Because without this foundation in place, again, our ideas of bhakti and our ideas of self-love will remain toxic, I will say, and destructive even. If our idea of self-love doesn't include bhakti, it's toxic and destructive in its own way. If our idea of bhakti doesn't include self-love, it becomes toxic and destructive in its own way. That's why in the title I try to use the two words, self-love in bhakti, not just self-love and not just bhakti. All of the two should include the other, but we just in case we need to clarify. You know? Like with sometimes Prabhupada will say, a bona fide guru. And it's like, sorry guys, I have to use the two words, but actually to say guru should be enough because a guru has to be bona fide. If not, it's not guru. But there is so many misrepresentations that we need to add bona fide guru. So when we say self-love, ideally we should think, oh, bhakti is part of that. And when I say bhakti, we should think, well, self-love is included in that. But just in case, we have named the series self-love in bhakti. Because the two of them balance each other. We don't want bhakti without self-love. We don't want self-love with bhakti. And just to make this point more clear, I'd like to analyze next, and you will help me hopefully with this, some of the consequences of accepting one without the other. Some of the consequences of accepting bhakti without self-love, some of the consequences of accepting self-love without bhakti. What can happen? Where we may end? So let's begin with bhakti without self-love. That's even where most of us begin sometimes. And we may practice bhakti, but without any consideration of self-love, as we have explained so far, as we'll continue to explain. But just loving God, serving Krishna, surrendering to Guru, whatever, but no self-love whatsoever. So I'm all ears.
Neglect of our needs, material needs.
Okay. Neglect of our material needs. I'm repeating because I'm streaming live here, so just for the people can listen.
Hardening of the heart.
Hardening of the heart. Thank you. Yeah, we are supposed to melt the heart. Rupa Goswami will say the heart has to become fluid, like honey, like ghee. But we can make it a rock as well. Yeah. In the name of bhakti, which is even more tricky. Something else. I have my own list, but I want to give you.
Some kind of martyrdom.
Sorry?
Some kind of martyrdom or expectation that loving God includes destroying himself.
Mm-hmm. Some kind of martyrdom. Or the idea of, okay, giving myself to God implies destroying myself or torturing my limbs or my mind or my whatever in some way or another.
I would add, like, going to extremes where you, like, excessively don't think about yourself and think about others and excessively think about yourself.
Yeah.
Because you're, like, ignoring this part of you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was planning to mention that one, how one extreme will shift into the other, which are two sides of the same coin in the end of the day. Yeah, thank you. Yes.
Without love or self-care, then my gifts cannot serve that.
Again, sorry, I didn't hear properly.
Without self-love, yes, or self-care, my gifts cannot serve God.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not serving in a healthy way because I'm not at my fullest potential to serve.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, we are not approaching God whole, no? With the whole, we are approaching him, not whole. Yeah, we go fractured, right? And maybe that affects our approach to him. I'm going to him so he fulfills my wholeness, cold with age, no, and only that, basically, right? Yeah. What else? Yeah, sorg.
An inability to receive the love that's all around us.
Okay, thank you. We develop a capacity to not receive, so to say, which is not easy to receive. Not many times we may emphasize we have to give, but it's a two-way street. It's reciprocal. No? So we also have to learn how to receive. Receiving is not necessarily a selfish act. It requires humility. It requires so many qualities to be a healthy receiver. It's not just about giving, and just exhausting our capacity, so to say, right? So, yeah, thank you.
You don't discharge the energy from holding space for others.
Mm-hmm. Not do not discharge.
Yeah, there's like an energy that comes from holding space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kind of like takes up in.
Okay.
It doesn't get released.
Okay. Okay. We cancel the natural flow in that interaction. Yeah. What else? Dr. Teresa.
Events that come to our life, we could see them more as a punishment. You know, God is punishing us as opposed to being an opportunity for growth and for healing.
Yeah. Yeah, I was reading recently about that, and I'll plan to talk about that maybe tomorrow. That if we have already a negative orientation, like I'm not enough, I'm terrible, whatever happens in my life, I'll see that's a confirmation of how terrible I am, basically. That confirms that I'm unlovable. That confirms that I absolutely whatever. So you further reinforce the pattern by everything that can happen in your life. Yeah. Katie?
Love ourselves. I wonder if it's possible to really love others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you don't love yourself, maybe it's difficult or impossible to love others. And of course, as I'm mentioning, and I will continue to mention in this connection, to love ourselves also something very important, at least in my opinion, to know first is to know that you are already loved by Krishna. So if I'm loved by someone, somehow I'm lovable. But if so far nobody loves me, Krishna included, probably I'm totally unlovable. So if I conclude in that direction, probably I won't dare to love anyone, including myself. So for me, the very powerful ground foundation to loving myself is to know Krishna is already loving me. There's something in me that he loves. Of course, the something is me, not something. Like one particle of your soul is lovable, but the 99.9%, sorry about that, no? So this the Atma, who we are, the soul, is loved by God and therefore lovable. Know that we are lovable means, okay, I can dare to love. But if nobody loves me, including Krishna, that means probably I came like failed from the factory, so to say. And I won't dare to enter into the adventure of daring to love anyone, including myself. No, so that's for me it's an important idea, very, very crucial. Because again, sometimes we may think Krishna will love you only when you do the needful to deserve it. I've seen devotees having that orientation in their practice. Krishna doesn't love me now. But when I become whatever, advanced, pure devotee, you use the term you want, then Krishna will love me. That doesn't speak so nicely about Krishna to begin with. No. Like imagine Krishna, like, no, I don't love you yet. But when you do this, become pure enough, become blah, 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 I will love you then. That's what we call conditional love. I put these conditions, when you fulfill them, I love you. Unconditional love is an oxymoron. There is no conditional love. If love is conditional, it's not love. Love, by definition, must be unconditional. And Krishna is made of love. he's made of unconditional love. So that's an important point. I will torture you for the next 2 or 3 days on this point with your permission or without it. Sorry. Because it's so cruel. Unless we understand Krishna already loves each of us fully and infinitely, and you are totally accepted by God already. Wow, that's like complete relief. Not relief in the sense I relax and do nothing, but complete relief in the sense that, wow, it's not that I have to earn Krishna's love. That makes no sense. And love is too much to be earned. You cannot deserve unconditional love. It's already there. What else? Something else? Sorry. I've lost and found in this list. Too much bhakti without self-love, so to say, quote unquote, too much bhakti. Yeah. Navita?
So maybe when we approach the bhakti or this process of mystical awareness or to evolve, we miss the point to love ourselves, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, when you approach this bhakti process, maybe nobody asks you if you love yourself or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's supposed that when you are approaching, it's nothing to do with you anymore, but it's Krishna and it's God. So it doesn't matter if you really love yourself or not.
Mm-hmm.
So to be, for myself, to be asked if I love myself along this path, this is the first time kind of like, do I love myself more than,
mm-hmm.
because with this, in this path, it's like, it's supposed that you love more to your guru, to Krishna, and sometimes you are neglecting yourself because that means, well, you have to be conscious about the process, not about yourself, because you are not this body.
Mm-hmm.
But with the time and with the years, you discover that, okay, wait a minute, I probably need this part of my life, or I need that to solve. So I think that with love, it will be more peaceful and harmonious to solve these problems, right? So I believe that maybe this question is so relevant. As you said, Maharaj, it's not like you have to be just... with this ego, right, to think about yourself, but it's like also you need to heal these psychological traumas that you had before to come to the temple, like to the process.
And all the traumas that came after going to the temple. I'm going there, yeah. Sometimes there are more after them. We don't want to say that, but just... Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate what you mentioned. Yeah, we are hearing all this. And for some reason, I didn't expect all these people. I was like, probably nobody will come because they read the title and say, this is completely nonsense, what Maharaj is talking, self-love. But it seems that we are in need of hearing. And yeah, I was thinking even to even put ourselves to test. I won't do the exercise now, but you can try yourself, look yourself at the mirror and say, I love myself, and try to see what comes from that. If you can say it from a proper place, or if all these voices start like, that's Maya, it's not correct, you are so arrogant, this is blah, blah, do, 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 and see what comes, no? Because the point is, we may not be, we are still convinced that we are not, again, lovable or worthy in any way. And as you say, you have to love Krishna, not yourself. And that creates a very dualistic dichotomy. Of course, we are not Krishna, but at the same time, we are not entirely separate from Krishna. We cannot, in the Veda-Veda equation, you cannot just say Krishna is absolutely different from everything else. In one sense, everything is Krishna. In the Abheda side of the equation, everything is Krishna. Sorry if it sounds impersonal, but that's half of the equation of our tradition. Everything is Krishna. In the sense that everything is interconnected with him, and you cannot just talk about us and Krishna as completely separate units. So, yeah, important. You raised your hand before, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to probably say everything you said in my own words, but yeah, I feel like if we don't love ourselves, it's fundamentally against truth.
mm-hmm.
said, because it's like, mm-hmm. we are part and parcel of Krishna. So that's the goal, is to love Krishna. So it must include ourselves. The other aspect is to receive a gift is to give a gift.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't receive that love for yourself, you're blocking the gift that Krishna wants to give.
Yeah.
So it's doing a disservice ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two wings of the heart, truth and love. So you need both to have that, you know, they have to work together. They support one another's existence.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the love and the truth support one another. So when we love ourselves, it's supporting truth. And the truth is that we logically do need to, you know, we logically do deserve love.
Mm.
Being a
part and parcel. Mm. Mm. And again, when we say we deserve love, it's not in the terms of I did my merit and I won it, but just because of who you are as a soul for your existence, you are worthy of God's love. It doesn't mean like I have to do this, and acquire this particular, like, I don't know, like labels. Okay, now I deserve Krishna's love. The Atma, the soul, for what it is, in that sense, it deserves. It's worthy of God's love. Not worthy in terms, not of, again, a personal merit that I did something and he didn't do, so he doesn't, but because of who we are. Not so much for what we did. Generally, we think too much, generally, in terms of you deserve something for what you do. You are worthy of something according to what you did. We don't think in terms of because of who you are. But that's how the logic of love operates. Krishna loves everyone unconditionally for who they are, not for what they did or what they didn't. That will make it conditional. Anyhow, the list can then go on forever. We'll go with one more.
I just want to reflect on this difference between liking and loving.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, can I love myself if I don't like the way I am now?
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, well, that's exactly what we need to do with other people, right? We may not like everything other people do to us or display to us, but we may still love them.
Mm-hmm.
And transcending this mode of consciousness of I can dislike is fundamental to love.
Yeah.
Only including to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, because ultimately the ultimate love for others is for who they are, and who we are ultimately is not a flawed entity. All that's basically like a superficial covering. And of course, that superficial covering also gives us the chance to give unconditional love, as you say. No, it's not that I love you when you are perfect. I love you when you adjust to my likings. That's not love to begin with. So that applies not only to others, but to ourselves as well. Like I was saying, you can look at the mirror and say, I will accept myself unconditionally. Ooh, maybe the mirror breaks, what you say. Or you break or the mirror breaks. I will accept myself unconditionally. And this is not a laziness project by saying that. It's just like creating a healthy foundation for changing whatever needs to be changed.
So that's not narcissism then?
No. No. Because narcissism has mostly to do when I see myself as an absolutely isolated unit, and I'm absorbed, like if I were the center of reality and everything revolves around me and converges in me. But when I'm duly aware of what's my role in the constellation, and I see myself as a part of this whole, as interrelated, interwoven, interconnected, that's a real picture. So there, yeah. We are going to narcissism in a few moments. Well, so some thoughts we are, again, the whole lecture could go on in this direction. What can happen when we embrace bhakti without self-love? Of course, that can create so many more terrible consequences because I cancel myself, I cancel my criterion, no critical thinking, no opinion, no individuation, no individuality, inhumanism in the name of transcendence. And many times even the relationship between guru disciple, unfortunately, at that time it is said just, you have to surrender, you are always wrong, the guru is always right, you don't think, and you just do what you are told to. I'm making it a little bit extreme. It's not always like that, but some of the other things like that, and that surrender and that's humility to cancel myself completely, that self-forgetfulness. And in the name of humility, we end up being traumatized, basically, in many cases. Or sometimes we go to quotes from Shastra about extreme expressions of humility from our greatest acharyas, but we cannot imitate those. No, if I try to imitate Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, whatever, Jagai Madai Haitimuni Had Sepapista Burisirakita Haitimuni Selagista, and the worm in the stool, and this, and the, I may get depressed, probably. I may not get it, since, because I don't have the insight and the realization to repeat those in words without being. You follow my point? So we are not to imitate, we are to follow in the footsteps. And that implies understanding from which place that person say that and where I am and what corresponds to me to say. How much I can say that same thing without going crazy, so to say. anyhow, some thoughts. So bhakti without self-love, as you can see, is not the prospect we want, because we will conclude the soul is not amazing, as we say before. Or even worse, as we say, the soul is not valuable at all. I'm not valuable, I'm not loving, lovable, and that's not bhakti. If you conclude like that, you are not practicing bhakti properly. That's the point. Because Krishna says the opposite. You are acharya. You are amazing. You are a miracle. You are shockingly marvelous. So not embracing that is going against Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita. So bhakti without self-love is not bhakti. And as we mentioned before, many of us may come to bhakti with some unresolved stuff, childhood trauma, low self-esteem, and lots of this stuff we are mentioning here. We may bring that in our baggage towards the bhakti experience, and we have to deal with that. Hopefully, when we are, as Navita was saying, when we are entering the temple first day, probably someone in the door, we have to establish that, ask you, do you love yourself? We can make that in the Bhakta program, class one. Hey, guys, do you love yourself? If not, we have to talk about it first. Because if not, in the name of humility and surrender, we can just reinforcing your trauma and your self-loathing and all that stuff. And it doesn't work like that. In time, the process becomes a torture. So we don't want that. Or as we say, some of us do not come with that baggage to the bhakti process, but acquire it surprisingly after joining in some level. You come with a relatively healthy self-esteem, and someone will tell, that's false ego, Prabhu. No? You should be humble. You should think bad about yourself. That shows that you are closer to Krishna. Okay? Things like that, unfortunately. I mean, I'm somehow, it seems that I'm making it extreme, but I'm giving a curated version of it. So that's how I interpret what Vishwanath Chakravarti calls bhakti yuta anartas, no? Which are anartas that you didn't have before bhakti, but you acquire after bhakti. Not because bhakti brings anartas, but the misrepresentation, misreading, misunderstanding of bhakti creates anartas. Or bhakti provides some fruits and you got attached to those fruits from the wrong place. So of course bhakti uproots anartas, but again, a misinformed approach to bhakti becomes a source of anartas. And that's not bhakti, but it seems like bhakti. It seems like bhakti, but you are just accumulating further anartas. Like Mahaprabhu's analogy of you're watering the upasaka, the weeds that are not the actual bhakti vine. It seems you're watering the bhakti vine, but actually you're nourishing what needs to be uprooted, so to say. Externally, it seems you're very paka, very nice, Sunday feast, everything in place. But we may be increasing our even trauma and unresolved stuff now in the name of Krishna and quoting the Bhagavatam to justify that. So it becomes even more complicated. Because now we have religious conviction, absolute concepts to justify my dysfunction. So that's a complex case. So needless to say, we are talking all this, hopefully to save ourselves from that or to need to solve whatever needs to be solved. Let's go for a minute to the other side of the toxic coin. Not bhakti without self-love. Let's go now to self-love without bhakti. Like we were talking before, sometimes from one place we jump to the other. So how does it look? Some of the byproducts of, okay, I got burned by practicing bhakti without self-love. I need to think about myself for a while. But now I jump to self-love and I forget bhakti because I don't want to hear anything about bhakti now. Because I had a wrong idea of bhakti and a wrong experience of bhakti, thinking that it's not about self-love. So I don't want to hear anything about bhakti now. I just want self-love. So how does it look? Mm-hmm. What we may call selfishness or self-centeredness. We start to see everything and everyone revolving around ourselves. Not only even in terms of self-sense enjoyment, no, but even in terms of just perceiving reality revolving around us and expecting things to happen in that way, which even I don't know. Social media nowadays creates lots of that. No? Like you make a post and it gives you the feeling for some. The whole world is will comment on that and it's looking for that and it's not at all. But you are given, you're boosted in this sense. So yeah, that's one idea. An overdose of subjectivity, so to say. Myself, but losing sight of what's my act. Raising your hand, sir.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say like, overly sensitive or like fragile, you know, so like easily offended about things.
Mm-hmm.
You think that you're really obsessing over yourself. So
a victim consciousness or
right,
things
right,
like that.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's another one. Very susceptible, and whatever someone says, I take it personal. Taking personal, that's one of. No, it's all about me. So you say that was against me. I saw it. I felt it. And everything is personal. And with this, we are not condemning anyone. We are just trying to also say all this in the context of self-love and compassion. If we happen to be doing some of that stuff on a daily basis, we probably are. Shamananda.
It could cause us to cultivate strong attachments to material things that may cause us suffering later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's another one. Thank you. Back to us.
As we kind of extend our sense of self into our community, then we think that our tradition is the tradition. Now we center our tradition as the best or the greatest, then we become exclusive.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, then we have the extensions of selfishness with all this elitism and tribalism. And of course, it's an extension of I am the best. No, my guru is the best. My community is the best. My deities are the best, of course. There's place for that. There's place for that. Relax, Tamal. There's place for it. Your deities are the best. I won't discuss that. This is getting fired up. Relax, my friend. Relax. In certain contexts, we're saying this. Yeah, yeah. Or what I like to call sometimes, I call my first book, we would call racism also. You become not racism, racism. You become racist in the context of rasa. No? My rasa is the best. No? This relationship with Krishna is the highest. Only this. Any other rasa is... No? So that's racism. No? Which, again, all that are like extensions of this selfishness. Like whatever is better for me is the best. It must be of universal application. Or other traditions, no? Like, yeah, I always like to recall what Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, like, every devotee thinks that their relationship with Krishna is the best, and everyone is correct. That's it. There's no place for all this nonsense that we are talking about here, but that can happen. As we mentioned before, also another option will be narcissism, which just is like a more entangled and complex version of self-centeredness to the point that you really cannot be empathic with anyone. There's no experience of what other person is doing because it's all about yourself to the utmost degree, so to say, right? Losing sight of the interconnectedness between everything and everyone. And we try to live an impossible life, so to say, a life that is not actually real. That's what we call Maya, basically. When you say you are in Maya, actually, I mean, first of all, you shouldn't be saying that to anyone. But the meaning of that is I lost sight of how everything is interconnected and I'm relating with myself or others as isolated units. That's illusion. That cannot be. But I'm insisting that it is. What else? Oh, yes.
There's also a block. It's only self-love. And there is no love for anything or anyone else than the flow of love. It's not
there. Yeah. And therefore, there is no love for us either. Although we call it only self-love, that's not very loving to the self either. Because the self is, again, it's not separate from everyone else. Yeah, thank you. Pardon?
Without bhakti, we can be cultivating false identity. A complete false identity. Is this the process of bhakti that is allowing us to dismantle false identity? Mm-hmm. So if we're trying to just love ourselves without the process of bhakti, we're highly putting ourselves in that situation of a false identity.
Okay, yeah, fostering a false sense of identity, which we can do with bhakti without self-love. No? So the interesting thing is some of the things that happen with one side of the coin happen with the other side of the coin, because at the end of the day, there are two sides of the same coin. Yeah, you were raising your hand. Yeah.
Lack of gratitude.
Lack of gratitude. Thank you. That's a good one. Yeah. Yeah, I will add also lack of capacity to be invulnerable also. Mm-hmm. And to be empowered by the vulnerability that comes from that, or lack of capacity to beg forgiveness and to hold myself accountable. If it's too much all about me, self-aggrandizement and entitlement and all of these type of things. So, yeah. And all this is about remaining human also, no? Remain accountable, remain forgiving. Compassion is about remaining human. So too much self-love goes against our own humanity, so to say.
But is that really self-love?
That's a point. That's a point we want to come here, no? That's not self-love. As the other list is not bhakti, this is not self-love either. So that's the conclusion I'm trying to reach. Sorry. You are giving us a trailer. No, it's okay. We need trailers sometimes. Of the... So yeah, basically that's the idea, no? Self-bhakti without love is self-love without bhakti. It's not self-love. And bhakti without self-love is not bhakti. In one sense, the two of them are inseparable. That's the point we want to, if you give me a few more minutes that we are reaching the conclusion today, that's the point we want to reach now. Self-love and bhakti are, how to say, yeah, not only balance each other and support each other, but one could say they are synonymous with each other. One speaks about the other and one confirms the other's existence. And the moment you take one out, you don't have the other anymore either. This is how enmeshed the two of them are, so to say. Enmeshed, you say entangled. Sorry, I'm practicing my new fancy English terms with you. So. But again, if we have the wrong idea of them, which is what we try to address him, a wrong idea of what's bhakti, a wrong idea of what's self-love. As I said before, I may be practicing bhakti without self-love till I got burnt out. And then I don't want to know anything about bhakti because I feel, no, bhakti increased my trauma. So that bhakti is a cult. Those guys are completely whatever. But no, it only means that you got the wrong notion, the wrong sambandha, the wrong definition of that. And the same with the opposite. If you leave bhakti with that idea and you run to self-love, probably you will commit the same mistake and define self-love in a wrong way, and we are seeing now the consequence of that. So running from, you are going from one misunderstanding, not to other misunderstanding, but from to the same misunderstanding from the other side of the coin. You follow my point? So in one sense, we are not going to the opposite side, although we think that, oh, I got burned with this bhakti stuff, I'll go to the opposite side, to self-love. No, no, you remain in the same place, stuck, just tasting different varieties of the same poison, so to say. Because you keep the wrong idea about all of that. Wrong idea about bhakti without self-love, wrong idea about self-love, not including bhakti. So basically here we are trying to hopefully share some ideas that may give us proper understanding of what is what. Because that's sambandha. If you don't have a clue what is what, you act on the basis of what you think reality is. So if your orientation to reality is misdirected, practice life will be misdirected and the fruit will be bitter, unfortunately. So and we see that a lot. I mean, I've seen that in our community, to be honest. Many devotees, unfortunately, embracing the practice of bhakti from a traumatizing place, traumatized and traumatizing. And at one point it's like, so where is he? Whew, completely disappeared, unfortunately, because he got burned and he didn't receive the, nobody asked him on day one, do you love yourself? So to say, no, this type of basic things to ground our humanity. So, and again, many of us probably have a taste of both of them. Many of us have had an experience of some expression of bhakti, which is not very human and sustainable or connected with self-love, or some attempts to self-loving ourselves, which were not very sustainable either. So here we are trying again to reach some synthesis of the two. Because, again, if not, that can be really traumatizing. In the name of bhakti, we can just increase trauma without knowing it. And that's not the idea. The idea is to heal, and the idea is to grow, of course. That's why you're calling self-love in bhakti. So both balance each other. Now, Krishna in the Gita, 6th chapter, says, yukta hara bihara se yukta chastasya karma, so and so on. He says everything should be yukta or balanced. No? Whether you're eating, you're sleeping, your recreation, everything should be balancing. Everything should be balanced and balancing one each other. So if you have self-love and bhakti, that should be expressed in a balanced way. Not too much bhakti without self-love, not too much self-love without bhakti, but a proper synthesis. Not canceling one another, but nourishing one another and showing how they are not one another. Again, as the toxic versions are two sides of the same coin, the healthy versions of bhakti and self-love are two sides of the same coin as well. They're not two separate coins either. So basically that's what I want to share today. Sorry if I extend myself a little bit, but I appreciate your presence and attention. So thank you for tolerating me. And yeah, just hopefully you can leave today's meeting with this idea clear, how bhakti and self-love are inseparable and one is part of the other. So there's no need to pick one, reject the other, but there's a need to understand how one includes and integrates the other, how the two are synonymous. We are, in that sense, we need a more integrative bhakti, let's call it like that, integrity, holistic bhakti, holistic bhakti, holy bhakti, not holy only, but holy with double, whole and holy, the two of them put together. We want holiness, not only wholeness, not only holiness, but holiness. Oh, that's the ideal of this integration. So that's it for today. Tomorrow we'll have a continuation for this series. It will be like a three-part, although I will try to give the lectures in a way that if you just can come to one or the other, you understand what I'm talking about. But it will be kind of a further unfolding of other things connected. So tomorrow we'll be talking about how this balance of self-love and bhakti takes place. How to put bhakti and self-love together in the way We relate to ourselves in our daily life, in our daily practice, to other living beings, to Krishna, but to ourselves as well. So that's it from my side. What time is it now? 7:22. If there are any questions you may like to share, we have a few minutes, Narayan?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have eternity. Eternity is on our side. Thank you. So if you have any questions or comments or further reflections, please, you can raise your hand.
I think that's something that you're planning to talk about.
Let's see.
But what about the relationship between the soul and the super soul in that process of self-love? You will focus a lot on how we love our soul. What about super soul and the role of the super soul in this process of developing self-love, I mean, the karma of the
organization. Yeah, somehow I plan to talk about that, especially in the last lecture. But of course, we can say something. So the role of the super soul in connection to the soul. Of course, super soul is another way to refer to God, basically. No? Because sometimes also, again, part of the chapter I'm in now is I'm trying to remember, remind ourselves, we say Paramatma, and we say Krishna, we say Narayan, we are talking about the same guy, right? Yeah, they are not different people. In one sense, they are different expressions of the same absolute, but they are not entirely different, because if not, we start to become polytheistic. Like Narasimha over there, and Bhavandev, and Mahaprabhu, and Paramatma, and Vishnu, and Vaikunth, they're all the same person. Which we need that non-dual foundation. That's what the Bhagavatam say. What's reality? Advaita Gyan Tattva. Reality is non-dual consciousness. So we need to understand the non-separatedness of these things. So Paramatma is in the heart. And when someone takes to bhakti, we'll say Paramatma is replaced by Krishna. Again, they are the same person. Paramatma shows himself as Krishna. Before bhakti, when someone, let's say he's an atheist person, I say God does not exist. I mean, Paramatma still remain there, patient enough, tolerant enough, forgiving enough, life after life, loving us unconditionally. So again, that's, I'm bringing that back to the point. You could say if you are not an official bhakta, an official theistic person, even in that case, God is loving you unconditionally and is present in the heart. I mean, he's present as closer as he can be to the Atma. I mean, he cannot get any closer. So that in itself speaks about how much he's there supporting, accompanying, validating, trying to. Chaitya Guru, says the Shastra, Paramatma or Krishna in the heart is the inner guru, the guru of the heart, trying to inspire, trying to direct, out of unconditional love. So I will say again, considering all that properly, that should foster our self-love. Because again, Krishna loves me so much. No? Not because I'm better than anyone else, but as we will talk on Sunday, I have been chosen by Krishna. I mean, not only me. Because when we hear chosen, in our dualistic framework, for us, chosen means someone else was not chosen. But when Krishna chooses, everyone gets chosen. And that's how he operates. When we say, oh, I chose him, means someone else was not chosen. But when Krishna chooses, everyone is inside the choice. But it's rightfully to say, I have been chosen. And you as well, and you as well, and you as well, and everyone as well. So from that place of chosenness, that's so validating for a healthy foundation of self-love. Because God, the most expert lover, has chosen me, and he's loving me, and he's accepting me fully. And I have to accept that myself. I have to love what he loves, as I say. St. John of the Cross will say, love what God sees in you. God sees something in you that he loves. You have to learn to love that. That's not easy. Again, for some, it may sound like self-indulgence. I will love myself. And That's way more difficult than not loving yourself. Not loving yourself, that's so easy. We're already doing that. Self-loathing, self-deprecation, ongoing, daily basis. I'm the worst of the worst, unloving, untrust, unworthy, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that soundtrack is sounding from time immemorial. To really love yourself from a correct perspective, that's hard work. What I'm sharing these days, it's not easy. I will never use the word easy in any of these 3 days. But we need to train ourselves to see ourselves from that perspective, to really understand Krishna loves me completely already. What remains is me reciprocating to that, giving back the embrace. That's the goal of life. Our goal of life is not love from Krishna. It's love for Krishna. Love from Krishna is given already from day one. But again, we need to really enter into that space and understand I'm the beloved of God. and live it. That's my identity. That's so empowering, so validating. As we will talk, I'm giving long trailer of Sunday class, but if someone asks you who you are, you can ask, I'm a beloved of Krishna. That's completely accurate. You are not indulging in any excess of subjectivity or of course, I'm the beloved of Krishna, as you are, as you are, as you are, as you are, as everything is. But I am the beloved of Krishna. That's who I am. Ultimately, that's one of the most beautiful ways to see yourself. I am the beloved of God, and he loves me, and I love what he loves in me, and I love his love in me. That's ultimately the goal. You have to fall in love with everything. Sorry, Lila, you were saying.
So then now I can actually love him properly.
Yeah.
Like those things.
Yeah.
Actually embodied, and we aren't showing up to the love.
Yeah. And for me, to
serving in fullness, and we're actually just wanting to be saved, and we're needing something which isn't actually clean and pure.
Exactly. So for me, that this is the ideal motivation to approach Krishna and love him. Because many of us try to love Krishna out of guilt, out of social pressure, out of deserving, out of he doesn't love me yet, so I have to love him first, so hopefully he likes me and he throws something back. From that place of scarcity or emptiness, instead of he loves me fully and I'm celebrating that, and part of my celebration is giving back the embrace and having the ideal intention to approach him out of gratitude and out of humility and out of being more, instead of just getting close to a guy who doesn't love me, who may get angry quite easily, who may send me, I don't know, we have such a bizarre ideas about who Krishna is, to be honest, sometimes, which art have nothing to do with the all attractive. He's the all unattractive. No? We have some ideas about Krishna. I've seen the books that, like, I'm not able to finish my 16 rounds, and I'm afraid that Krishna may deprive me of human form next lifetime. I'm like, wow. That's not Krishna. That's not Krishna. Sorry. that's not how it works. That's not how bhakti operates. I mean, you read what Krishna says in the Gita at every single moment. Neha vikram nasasti name bhakta pranashati. My devotee never perishes. Whatever you acquire here, never lost. I will provide whatever you need. Yogakshimam bahamyaham. I won't torture you with the quotes, but it's everywhere. And one of the aspects, central aspects of sharanagati or surrender to Krishna is you trust that Krishna will protect you always. And you accept that he's maintaining you. Maintaining doesn't mean he will pay my bills, or he's maintaining you by his unconditional love. That's the more substantial maintenance. And sharanagati means live your life accepting that fact. And that's the core aspect of saranagati, the angi.
It's a threshold. There's a space of absolute shelter, and there's a space of chaos and samsara.
Mm-hmm.
And the qualification to cross that threshold is to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't accept, we like spit ourselves out back into like a needless chaos.
Yeah. 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 So I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes.
Something.
So your thoughts.
Yeah. Again, we are working together here. Yeah. Yes.
self-love without bhakti also can lead us to lose the purpose of our existence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Atma itself, you know, has some activities, transcendental and spiritual activities. And because we are covered, we don't see the Atma. And so we, and it's covered, so we need a process to see our real self. So bhakti is that process that helps us to see our real self.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, if nobody knows how to approach, right? If you don't approach through the bhakti, then it becomes what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, or I'm just myself and nobody else is good as I am.
Mm.
But the bhakti gives you that, that perception that the purpose of your life or your existence, not only life, but existence itself, it's to serve God.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the dharma, the atma dharma. It's the function of the self,
mm-hmm.
the real self.
Yeah.
So I think that bhakti, I mean, self-love without bhakti, can make you be more, as you were saying, cultivating more of this bodily conception.
Mm-hmm.
It still is in the mind, it still is in the psychology, but you didn't touch the Atma really.
Mm.
So as Srila Prabhupada would say, we don't know how to love, although we are speaking
mm-hmm.
a lot of, I love you, I have to love myself,
mm.
but actually we don't know unless we connect with the supreme love.
Mm.
So if we start this process of bhakti, then we can learn how to love ourselves and how to love God, because actually we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So my also I have a question, I think. So in this path, it's also say that because you don't know how to love, then you accept a person who knows how to love. And that is the guru, the bona fide guru,
mm-hmm.
who helps you to develop your love.
Mm-hmm.
The love that already exists in you because you are made of love.
Mm.
But because you are in this maya, in this body, so and in this mind, so you don't know how to go through that. But the guru, with the torchlight of knowledge,
mm.
will help you to get there.
Mm.
So also to just think of, I have to love myself, also means that you have to accept some another authority who is beyond that matter, right? Beyond that conception. So
mm-hmm.
also the self-love means, I don't know, that's my question.
Mm.
It's like to accept that personality, that bona fide person who will help you to love.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Of course, we need, no, thank you. We need guidance. And sometimes, as you mentioned, we may not have proper knowledge, proper orientation. We may not know how to love. We may not know what love is, because love is one of the most popular words. The words we use the most generally are the ones we understood the least, understand the least. I love you. It's like we don't, but many times we don't know what's I, what's you, what's love. No, so I remember actually like 15 years ago or maybe more, I was in Argentina giving a lecture to, we were living in at the farm at that time, and we have this like woofers programs. So we have like volunteers from all world every day for years, no, like 30, 40, staying 3 months. So it was an interesting experience. And we were doing classes, like Istagosik, you know. And once someone asked, like, so can I, is it possible to love oneself? And I remember what came was like, well, it depends what you mean by love and depends what you mean by oneself. Because if we don't have the idea clear on that, and for that many times, of course, we cannot figure all the things out by ourselves. That's the point. So there's always the importance of revelation and guidance. And all that can be an aspect of self-love as well, of course. Of course. Yeah, thank you. Yes. What's your name, sir?
Pishima.
Pishima, yes.
Would you say that, or is it possible to practice true humility and bhakti yoga without that aspect of self-love?
I think you already know my answer to that. What will you say? What will you say?
I will say no.
I will say no also. Yeah. Yeah. Of course, there are degrees of humility. You talked about true humility. So I don't want also to sound like black and white. No, there are degrees of humility. And at one level, one in one's vision and capacity, one may conceive humility more in a self-denial type of way. And it's the best you can do at that time. And you're sincere and honest. And it's a kindergarten humility. And it's okay. Everyone has to go to kindergarten, so to say. But at one point, it has to grow and mature to integrate and incorporate things like self-love. No, because again, as I hope you had the experience at some point where we were talking about the things, talking about self-love should be humbling, basically. Hopefully, after this class, nobody goes out this door like, okay, I realize I'm amazing, and I know it was, yeah. And you should be amazingly humble as well, because yeah, the amazingness of the soul is not of our own making. It's there. We are that. It's there, and we are unconditionally loved by God, without us even knowing that God exists. So all those things should be humbling, And love is humble in itself. Follow my point. I mean, you cannot separate love and humility. So any form of love, including self-love, has to include a corresponding expression of humility. If not, it's not love. Sanatana Goswami makes that point in Briha Bhagavatamrita. He says between prem and dainya, humility and prem. He makes like the two are synonymous. The more you have one, the other increases. The more we have the other increases. You have more love, there is more humility. The more humility, the more love. The two of them act as cause and effect of each other, he says. No? So he makes this like marriage between love and humility. You cannot separate them. So regarding your question, the conclusion is, yeah, any form of love has to have a corresponding form of humility. So humility without self-love, how much that is humility. But again, it's a self-love in the context of bhakti, because only self-love is not self-love, as we say. No? Yeah.
So I was reflecting on what Krishna said also, and with the John of the Cross comment about that we should love what God sees in us.
Mm.
So that's where the space of humility comes in, because it's not that God sees the material things about us that we could get puffed up and proud about.
Mm.
He sees us as the soul. So that's how the humility remains in place with self-love, because if we're loving what God sees in us, It's the soul. It's not those other things that
mm-hmm.
make us falsely proud.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's the point. When you enter in contact with who you are as a soul, you can never become proud of that. The actual proof that you contacted your being is humility, again. Because, and let me take it to another layer of conversation, but it's related. When you contact the soul, you also contact the unlimited potential that the soul has for love in relation to the infinite. And when you approach the infinite in that context, you realize there is no limit to how much progress I can make here. And that's humbling, to say the least. Overwhelming, probably. You follow? Srila Samaraj will say that. The closer you get to the infinite, my hands cannot make it, the closer you get to the infinite, the more you realize there's no limit to how much I can serve, to how much I can love, how much I can make progress, to what's my potential. So that's humbling. You follow? There is some call somewhere. Just in case. From the infinite, maybe. So yeah, real contact with the soul implies you cannot separate the soul from the soul's potential, because we are units of potential. We are tathasta. So we are our potential. We are all that we can be. And our potential is unlimited in connection to the infinite. So when you enter those realities, infinite and unlimited, there's no place for arrogance or feeling like I'm like, here I am. No, it's like I'm just coexisting with infinity and eternality and endless prospect. And I can only just like serve that more and more. That's why Srila Semaras will say when someone asks, what's prem? No. If you go to someone like Srila Semaras with that question, better you fasten your seatbelt. Like Srila Semaras, what's prem? And he will give this genius, beautiful like definition. He won't go to the official definition, but he will go to the implications of those definitions. He'll say, prem means that you receive an unlimited amount of service to offer in service, a limited amount of energy to offer in service. That's prem. You are absolutely empowered by the topmost wave of energy. And what to do with that? I cannot keep that for me. It's like too much. So you offer that in service. So again, how can you think even that you will be proud of arrogance in the context of such an invasion? So to say. That will be absolutely humbling. Yeah. And I'm just consuming the thought in theory in my mind. I'm not there. It's already just humbling to think about the theoretical possibility of that, what to speak of being immersed in that ocean. So yeah. Okay. Something else?
I just feel like this concept of like self-love, like striving for that separately from bhakti, as if it's this like secret, like, oh, we really want it, but we shouldn't go for it. It's not that at all. It's like that is the highest form of doom and misery, because you are condemning yourself to not have a relationship
mm-hmm.
with God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are created for.
Mm-hmm.
That was God's purpose for us,
mm-hmm.
was to have a relationship with Him.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, narcissism to me looks like hell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is.
Yeah.
True hell, it's not like you're really getting something good out of it.
No.
I just wanted to shine that light there.
Yeah, thank you. That reminds me one quote from Thomas Merton, which is one of my favorite Christian mystics. And he will say, basically, I'm not probably repeating it literally, but he will say that when you see that in your life everything revolves around you and converges in you, you are at the doors of hell. Mm-hmm. Like literally bringing hell to that, not so much as, okay, it's a geographical location that you will be thrown at some point, but it's a state of consciousness. It's, Vrindavan is a state of consciousness, hell is a state of consciousness as well, and yeah, narcissism implies
forgetting God, forgetting
yeah.
the spiritual world.
And forgetting everything, because you don't care for anyone else, only care for yourself, but even the idea that you have of yourself as a narcissistic, it's not yourself. So basically, you are not contacting anyone in actual reality, so to say. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, we are 1 hour and 30 minutes, so I think we can stop here and let what we have shared continue to be processed somehow. And of course, if you have time and chance, tomorrow we will be continuing. Tomorrow we'll be at Pranada's house. So those who have time or who would like to join, don't have the address, you can ask us and we can share. And Sunday will be at Archana City's house at the same time, 5:30 p.m. So thank you so much. And should we do some, yeah, what? Okay, I understood the mudra and the glance. So the conclusion of that is we'll have kirtan by Dhanya. right? That was the mudra.
Yeah.
Okay. Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu Ki Jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Priman Hari Vanchakalpa Taru Vistra Kripa Sindhu Bheva Chapati Tanam Pavani Pya Vashna Vibhya Namo Ananta Koti Vashna Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Hari Vrinda.